From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we have a story that helps explain how the hostile takeovers of the 80s led to bankruptcy and unemployment in the 90s. The story involves some of America's best-known department stores, like Bloomingdale's, Brooks Brothers, Ann Taylor, and Filene's, which were taken over in the 80s by Canadian developer Robert Campo. We'll talk with John Rothschild, author of a new book about Campo, and how he bankrupted the retail industry and crashed the junk bond market. Also today, Soviet expert William Potter discusses one of the most unsettling aspects of the breakup of the Soviet Union, the selling of Soviet nuclear technology to the Third World. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews this season's big movie, Hook. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's mounting pressure for Mikhail Gorbachev to resign as president of the evaporating Soviet Union. Despite persistent rumors from the Kremlin he'll step aside, that action doesn't appear imminent. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
According to his spokesman, President Gorbachev will not resign, at least until he meets with Secretary of State James Baker on Monday. Several sources close to Gorbachev have reportedly said over the last 2 days that Gorbachev is considering resigning and that he may leave office soon. Gorbachev himself said yesterday that he would quit as president if it became apparent that the former republics of the Soviet Union would choose to join the Commonwealth of Independent States rather than remain in a political union under his leadership. Today, the five Soviet Central Asian republics joined Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in opting for that Commonwealth. There have been suggestions that a role might be found for Gorbachev in the Commonwealth, but he himself has ruled that out, saying, "I will not participate in the slicing up of the Soviet Union." I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
A leader of one of the warring factions in the East African nation of Somalia called today for foreign intervention to stop an armed power struggle in the capital city. Aid officials in Mogadishu say that as many as 3,000 people have been killed in 4 weeks of fighting between the two main factions. According to the Reuters news agency, a faction leader has called for a ceasefire to be followed by the creation of a military buffer zone in Mogadishu. The leader, Hashi Igal, said that the United Nations or the United States should be prepared for military intervention if the truce fails. Aid officials said today that the two sides are fighting in the center of the city with mortars and rocket launchers. Florida Democrats met this weekend in Orlando for the nation's first presidential straw poll. The non-binding ballot of convention delegates is largely symbolic, but it's the first political test in a late-starting presidential campaign. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Across the street from Disney World, more than 2,000 Florida Democrats have come together for a weekend convention. Although Democrats downplay the importance of the straw poll, four of the six presidential candidates will woo delegates through the weekend. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton and Iowa Senator Tom Harkin are considered to have the edge. Clinton has strong support among state party leaders. He received the endorsement of Florida's lieutenant governor last month, and he's the former chair of the Democratic Leadership Council, a centrist party organization with strong ties in Florida. More than a quarter of the delegates are from organized labor, which helps populist candidate Tom Harkin, the only candidate to address the AFL-CIO convention last September. The straw poll occurs Sunday. I'm Elizabeth Arnold. In Orlando.
Prices closed higher on Wall Street for the third straight day today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 20 points to finish the day at 2,914.38. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of about 194 million shares. This is NPR. U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hills is working to resolve a trade dispute with Mexico before the presidents of the two nations meet to discuss a comprehensive free trade agreement. Mexico has closed its borders to U.S. fruit and live hogs, claiming that it's worried about insects and illnesses. Hill said today that she's suggested putting joint teams of inspectors along the border so they can examine any products that might be tainted. Critics of the proposed free trade agreement, like Senator Tom Daschle, a Democrat from South Dakota, said Mexico's border closure shows its commitment to free trade is a sham. A federal grand jury has indicted 9 Detroit police officers who allegedly hired themselves out as guards for undercover FBI agents posing as drug couriers. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The indictments charged that the 9 officers and 2 civilians accepted a total of $150,000 to provide protection for drug traffickers awaiting major shipments of cocaine at Detroit's two major airports. What they didn't know was that those they were providing the service for were actually federal agents looking for evidence of corruption within the Detroit Police Department. The arrests actually took place in May of this year. Since then, the grand jury has been investigating the case. Among those indicted was a brother-in-law of Detroit Mayor Coleman Young. FBI officials insist that none of the accused was entrapped or otherwise enticed into doing anything they wouldn't have done on their own. Police Chief Stanley Knox says he will meet with department attorneys today to decide if the officers involved should be suspended without pay. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A spokesman for the U.S. airline industry called today for tax relief for American air carriers, saying the companies face losses of almost $2 billion this year. Robert Aronson of the Air Transport Association of America said that air traffic was dried up by the Persian Gulf War and kept down by the recession. He said that Congress should cut the taxes on passenger tickets, now set at 10%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have something for you to think about as you do your holiday shopping. It's the story of why a lot of established American department stores are now bankrupt. More specifically, it's the story of Robert Campbell, the Canadian real estate developer who bought two chains of American department stores in the mid-'80s. His holdings included Bloomingdale's, Brooks Brothers, Jordan Marsh, Filene's, and Ann Taylor. His hostile takeovers were financed with junk bonds. By January 1990, his two chains were in Chapter 11. The Campo deals brought lots of business to the bankruptcy courts, but it's been bad news for American retail. About 8,000 people lost their jobs, and 50,000 creditors filed approximately $8.2 billion in claims. My guest, John Rothschild, is the author of the new book, Going for Broke, How Robert Campo Bankrupted the Retail Industry, Jolted the Junk Bond Market, and Brought the Booming 80s to a Crashing Halt. I asked Rothschild why Campo wanted to get into retail when he knew nothing about it.
Well, I think he wanted to get into almost anything. I mean, it seemed that he wasn't satisfied with being a real estate developer. He was from an area called Sudbury, and apparently there was a regional aspect to it. And I think some people regarded him as a bit of a yokel, even though he'd sort of come up through Ottawa, built a lot of buildings there in the government center, and then went on to Toronto and sort of made his mark on the skyline of all of these cities. But it seems that it wasn't enough. He felt he hadn't gotten enough respect. And he started this sort of odd business of looking at takeovers in all directions in Canada to start out with. He looked at trust companies. He looked at broadcasting companies. He looked at tiny companies that made things like cardboard houses, and he was sort of flying off in a dozen different directions, and the people around him sort of tried to rein him in. And in Canada, he seemed to be fairly successfully reined in and kept in real estate, which he understood.
Well, what exactly did he want? He just wanted to take over anything?
I think he just wanted to be thought of as more important than just a real estate developer. And throughout this story, the theme develops that he would always comment on world politics or on oil prices or on what's happening in the Soviet Union. And I think he really wanted to be the U.S. Secretary of State or something. And I think he wanted to be thought of as very important and invited to all the right parties, and especially in America. So I think the takeover for him was a vehicle toward some kind of self-esteem as opposed to just money.
So why Allied, the department store conglomerate?
Well, there's a sort of funny story. He was looking at a savings and loan in his search for taking over something, and he was looking at an American bank, and he was talked out of the bank, and the savings and loan, the investment bank Shearson had come up to Canada and had he engaged them to search for a savings and loan. They found one in California. They tried to get back to Bob Campo, but he was off having a facelift. He always had other priorities besides his business. The sideshow in this story is his self-improvement, his flying around getting injections for longevity and facelifts and having people following him squeezing fresh orange juice every 15 minutes because he didn't trust it if it was older than 15 minutes. And so he sort of had a designated orange juice squeezer for a time following him around. But anyway, so because he was off having this facelift, the savings and loan deal fell apart. And the people in Canada who were helping him do these things, contact banks, try to find companies to take over, were getting sort of tired of him. And they sent him off to a rather obscure investment advisor in New York, a place called Tribco Partners. And the fellow at Tribco Partners had a friend in Allied Stores. And his thought was maybe Bob Campbell, being in real estate, might buy a couple of shopping centers out of this huge company called Allied Stores, which owned, among other things, Brooks Brothers and Ann Taylor. And when he first brought it up with Campo, he said, what's that? He hadn't heard of Allied Stores. So here's a company that he didn't know anything about, and then 8 months later he owned the company. Sort of the most bizarre story, I think, in the 80s financial history.
Well, there's something very frightening about this story, that somebody who knows absolutely nothing about retail but who wants to improve himself and his reputation should buy all these, you know, great American department stores and have no idea what to do with them.
Right. I guess from a Horatio Alger point of view, it's sort of inspiring. But for the corporate culture or the economy, it is kind of frightening. I mean, here was this guy who, you know, knew nothing about retailing, and also his management style was a bit unstable. I don't think he could have gotten a job at Allied Store in the management, certainly.
Because he wouldn't have known enough.
Right, he wouldn't have known enough, and also he was, quite frankly, a little strange. But all of a sudden, you know, he probably couldn't get a job there, but he owned the place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Rothschild, and his new book, Going for Broke, is about Robert Campo and how he took over two huge chains of American department stores and ended up putting both of them into bankruptcy. Now, this takeover of Allied was the biggest hostile takeover of anything in the United States except for an oil company. How did he plan the hostile takeover?
Well, he wasn't even sure what a hostile takeover was. You know, when he came to New York, he was looking for investment banks after he decided Tribco Partner wasn't going to be big enough for him. And it was almost like dialing a bank. He was looking up in the Yellow Pages. Drexel he could have gone to, First Boston. Actually, he didn't go to Drexel, but he was sort of dialing for dollars and wandering around, and the takeover strategy kind of developed on its own in lunchroom conversations. I mean, the essence of it is there was no strategy to begin with. And the bankers never thought this man could take over Allied Stores, but they decided to play along with him in the hope that somewhere down the line there might be a side deal. Maybe he'd buy a part of Allied. Maybe he'd buy the shopping centers that were initially introduced to him through Tribco Partner. So the thing sort of gathered its own momentum. Most people, including Campo's own advisors, thought it was a crazy scheme. But then it gathered its own momentum, and ultimately he had the company.
Now, Campo financed the takeovers through junk bonds. Explain for us what that means.
Well, actually, he financed them through a combination of regular bank loans, secured loans, sort of similar to what we get when we buy a house and get a mortgage, and junk bonds. And essentially, junk bonds are just bonds where there's very little security. There's no asset there if the company goes under that the bondholder will get. So a junk bond is just the riskiest form of lending. If you and I went to our friends and said, you know, we'd like you to give us some money, we don't have any assets, but we think we can pay you back, that would be a junk bond.
And in return, the person loaning the money gets a high interest rate.
Right, a high interest rate for the risk. I mean, I guess it's sort of like vigorish, I guess they used to call it, with the old loan sharks. I mean, I think the whole junk bond thing isn't far away from the days of street loan sharks.
Now, you write that the deal was also financed in part by paper in kind, PIK, which you describe as even junkier than junk bonds. And you say that the success of this deal revolutionized the pricing of deals.
Yes, it did. I mean, the financing got thinner and thinner, and at some point, they weren't even satisfied that maybe the money wouldn't be paid later. They were paying paper with paper, and the idea in this PIK thing was that instead of getting actual cash for your loan, you would get more paper, and then sometime up the road, maybe in 10 years, you'd have amassed a lot of paper that would be supposedly worth something. I mean, it's sort of like buying Confederate bills, but you know in advance that the Confederacy's lost the war. I mean, it's really a strange form of financing. But based on the fact that they could find greater fools to buy these bonds, then they put a higher price on the companies that they were taking over.
Now, First Boston loaned Campo a lot of money for the takeover deal, but apparently they didn't do a very good check on him. What are some of the things they should have known about Robert Campo that they didn't find out about?
Well, one of the first things they should have known is that he, for a while, years earlier, had carried on a subterfuge with two families in Canada, where he had a wife and children in Ottawa, And then he had a mistress and children in Montreal, and he was vacillating back and forth like some kind of landlubber's version of Captain's Paradise, if you remember that movie. I don't think that the bankers necessarily had to know that, because people's romantic or sexual activities have to be known. But the funny thing about it is the way he handled this, it just got so complicated, and it was an exact replica of what happened when he got involved with the banks. So in that sense, I think they would have been well advised to have known about this. They quickly learned about his volatile temper, because, you know, he abused all the bankers who lent him the money. He was not a very polite person. He would slam doors on them. He had a habit of calling them at 4:30 in the morning with new ideas for money they should be loaning him. And he was very imperious in his attitudes. And they did learn that and kept lending to him. So I guess the knowledge of what he was like as he revealed himself didn't deter them in the end.
He'd also had a couple of nervous breakdowns that were associated in part with other deals.
Yes, he would get very giddy and optimistic and sort of take himself, I think, and he worked very hard. You know, he sort of was one of those 20-hour-a-day people who would be calling all night on one deal or another. And he always had 10 side deals going for every deal. So I think he worked himself into exhaustion. And then great depressions would set in, and he'd have to go off and sort of take himself out of circulation for 6 months or a year to gather his energy. And these are also things that were known in Canada, but I don't think the bankers in the U.S. knew much about it at all.
Soon after Campo managed to buy Allied Stores, he wanted to buy another chain of departments, another conglomerate of department stores, Federated Stores, which included Bloomingdale's, Burdine's, Filene's, and a bunch of others. How soon after Allied did he want to buy Federated, and what for? I mean, he just bought this really big company of stores. What did he need another one for, especially so soon?
Well, I think it was part of that restless dare to be great energy that he had. You know, he had something really big, and then he thought, I'm even more important than this. I want something really, really big. And he used to say that Brooks Brothers was, you know, the love of his life and the one thing he'd always wanted. And then once he had it, he lost interest in it right away, and he wanted the next thing, which was Bloomingdale's. And he got quite enamored of Bloomingdale's, and it wasn't more than 6 months into Allied, and after all, here he is with $4 billion in loans, now running the major company. And he was running it himself for a time because he didn't get along with the management. The original idea was he would bring in a professional manager, and eventually he did that. But for a long period of time, he was sort of like George Steinbrenner. I mean, he was very involved in every aspect. He used to walk into the stores and tried to get the Brooks Brothers suits changed more to a European cut, which was more to his liking. And, you know, he sort of meddled in every aspect of the stores. But it wasn't long before he decided, it wasn't important enough. Bob Campo was bigger than Allied. Bob Campo wanted Federated. Bob Campo wanted the world. So off he was to buy another chain.
Now, did he have to dismantle part of Allied in order to finance buying Federated?
To a degree, although he had to dismantle Allied to finance Allied, the way these so-called leverage buyouts worked was that you would take a company. It was almost like stripping a car of its parts. You would take a company, and you would sell off certain divisions and use that money to pay back some of the short-term debt that you had taken on to buy the company. And then you'd be left with a smaller company and supposedly a company that could handle its debt. So he had already sold off several divisions of Allied before he even thought about Federated. But then when Federated happened, he had to sell off more, and one of the ones he had to sell off was Brooks Brothers, which he'd told people again and again that he would never sell, was the love of his life and, you know, the most important thing that would ever happen to him. So, you know, here we had him running around trying to peddle Brooks Brothers.
See, I find it really interesting that an old establishment store like Brooks Brothers sort of suddenly become part of all these, like, new go-go money deals.
Well, I think that's what happened when all of these stores got, you know, they got brought into the department store conglomerates. The same thing happened with Rich's, which was an old family outfit in Atlanta, which became part of Federated in the mid-70s against the advice of one of the people in the Rich family I'm aware of. But then once they were part of these big conglomerates, they were sort of, you know, they were targets. They were defenseless. The funny thing is that the boards of directors of these companies were really legally bound to sell the company once it was put, quote-unquote, into play, which is what they called this game of leverage buyout, so that they couldn't even refused to sell it to somebody that they thought was going to run it into the ground.
Why not? Why couldn't they refuse?
Well, because since these were public companies, their mandate was to get the best value for the shareholders. And if once it seemed that the company was to be sold, then their only mission was to make sure that the shareholders got the most money for their stock. And you can see how a shareholder would be upset if instead of selling to Bob Campo, they'd sold, let's say, to somebody who knew something about retailing. Instead of giving him $73 a share or giving the shareholders $73 a share, they had sold it for $66. The shareholders would have been yelling and screaming, and there would have been lots of lawsuits. So in a way, once the thing got rolling, even though most people, I think, in this deal would rather not have sold to Bob Campo, they almost had no choice.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Rothschild, author of the new book, Going for Broke, How Robert Campo Bankrupted the Retail Industry, Jolted the Junk Bond Market, and Brought the Booming 80s to a Crashing Halt. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. John Rothschild is my guest, and we're talking about Robert Campo, who took over two huge chains of department stores, which together included Bloomingdale's, Brooks Brothers, Ann Taylor, Filene's, and lots more. In September of 89, Campo had a cash crisis, and he hinted that he might miss a payment on the junk bonds. And you say that's when the junk bond market collapsed in sympathy. What happened, and what did it mean?
Well, actually, the junk bond market had been going down. It had already had a series of shocks. But this seemed to be the most shocking. Here was a major company that was about to default on its bonds, or that was intimating that it might not be able to pay. And for a day or two, apparently there were hardly any buyers or sellers in the entire junk bond market. And the value of the junk bonds in other enterprises fell in sympathy with the Campo bonds, because people began to see that, you know, maybe a lot of other companies wouldn't be paying on their junk bonds either. So it had a tremendous psychological effect on the whole market.
Now, both Allied and Federated department stores went into bankruptcy in January of 1990. Who were the big losers?
Well, I think the biggest losers were the small vendors, the people on 7th Avenue that manufactured dresses or blouses or swimsuits, who had sent merchandise in December of 89 to all of the stores, thinking, as they always had, that they would be paid. And what happened once the bankruptcy occurred, they weren't paid for their merchandise and still haven't been. So they were left holding the bag for many millions of dollars. And I think some of the smaller people had a very hard time coping with that. I talked to a couple of people who had to lay off. These are people who only employed 30 workers to begin with, but they might have to lay off five or six of them right away because they hadn't been paid the money that they needed to keep in business. So vendors, number one. Obviously junk bond holders, many of which were institutions who aren't getting paid the interest on their junk bonds. So I think off the bat, those are the two major groups of losers. And, of course, the big banks like Citicorp that put together the commercial lending syndicates that lent huge amounts, and we see the problem with banking that we have today. And one of the reasons is that banks lent so much money to leverage buyouts. So those are three main areas, I guess, where people were hurt by it. And a lot of people were laid off in the two chains. I know in Miami they once had a pink slip party at one of the Jordan Marsh stores. And this is before the recession. Retailing was still doing fairly well. So many people lost their jobs also.
It's the Christmas season. A lot of us are heading to the department stores to do Christmas shopping. What effect does the Campo deal and bankruptcy have on us shoppers now?
Well, I think you could say that retailing was having its troubles even without Campo, but I liken it to the airline industry, where a few of the companies who were in the worst shape had to discount their ticket prices, which forced all the other airline companies to do the same. And I think you find that in retailing, that especially in 89, this cycle of markdowns began to accelerate as the Campo stores, desperate for cash, had to lower the prices on all their goods so that people would buy them. And I think, people now anticipate sales and, won't buy anything unless it is marked down. And I think that that cycle was greatly accelerated by Campo.
So if we shop today at Bloomingdale's or Jordan Marsh or Filene's or any one of the number of stores that were involved in these Campo takeover deals, who owns them now?
Well, I guess the bankruptcy court owns them. The debtors own them. The company, the company still exists, but they are in bankruptcy. I think when you shop and you look at the low prices, you can sort of thank Bob Campo for some of that. But then if you've been laid off, or if you haven't been able to get a loan at the bank, or if you can't afford what's there anyway because you don't have the money, in a way you can thank Bob Campo for that too. So you sort of get a good deal on one side and a bad deal on the other.
What impact do you think that Campo's bankruptcies had on leveraged buyouts and hostile takeovers and, the crazy economic financial dealings of the 80s?
Well, the big innovation in the Campo deal, and First Boston did this, I still wonder why it is they ever did this. They not only were the bridesmaids to this arrangement, usually the investment bank would put together the deal and then take fees, but First Boston also put its own money into both Campo deals. And this was revolutionary, was to take their own corporate capital and put them into essentially one of these risky undertakings. And they did it first in Allied, and they did it again in Federated. And the idea was they would get their money back once the junk bonds were sold, and some of the proceeds would be used to repay them for their bridge loans, as these things were called. So the Campo deal also created a flood of these bridge loans of other investment banks putting their own money into deals. Part of the reason they were doing this was to counteract Drexel Burnham Lambert's ability to raise huge amounts of money with Michael Milken. And so some of the regular investment banks started this idea of using their own money in deals. And there were several ancillary fiascos from that. So, the Campo thing, if you had to pick one single takeover event in the 80s that had the most ramifications, I think this would be it.
So Campo started this practice of banks using their own money, but
yeah,
it also ended it too?
Exactly. It wasn't his idea. It was actually Bruce Wasserstein's idea, who was the great takeover wizard at First Boston, who took Campo on as a client. Then after Wasserstein did it with Allied, then, the other investment banks wanted to copy him, and many others did it. So, it was the beginning of the end of that whole trend. Between 1987 and 1990, many of those kinds of loans were made, but not anymore.
Do you see the story of Robert Campo as being bigger than the story of Campo himself?
Yeah, I think it's the story of a financial system gone wild. Bankers lending in all directions without really stopping to think what they're doing. I think it's a story of take fees now and don't worry about tomorrow. And I think it's a story that explains, as well as any other, the predicaments that we're in today.
The financial predicaments.
Yeah. I think we'll be paying for this for a long time.
Well, John Rothschild, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. Thanks, Terry.
And John Rothschild is the author of the new book, Going for Broke, and it's about the Robert Campo takeovers of two big chains of department stores, how he bought them and how he made them bankrupt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Soviet Union has ceased to exist, but its thousands of nuclear weapons are still very much with us. And now with the Soviets facing economic catastrophe, there's growing pressure to sell off those weapons and the scientific expertise behind them. Coming up, we talk about how the end of the Soviet Union is changing the international nuclear picture with William Potter. He recently led a conference in the Soviet Union on nuclear nonproliferation. At $70 million, Steven Spielberg's new film, Hook, is the second most expensive movie ever made. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us if it's worth spending your money to see Hook. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Soviet Union, five more Soviet republics say that they will join a new commonwealth, meaning that now more than 90% of the Soviet population is moving in that direction. Soviet leader Gorbachev is trying to preserve a single state with the central government in Moscow. A commonwealth would make each of the various Soviet republics fully independent, although they would share control over nuclear weapons. A spokesman has said that Gorbachev plans to step down as a matter of principle if a majority of the 12 remaining Soviet republics join the Commonwealth. Both Britain and Germany have responded positively to the U.S. call for a meeting in Washington early next month to coordinate emergency aid to the Soviet Union. NPR's John Edstey reports.
A British foreign ministry spokesman said his government welcomed the U.S. initiative, announced yesterday by Secretary of State James Baker. But he also pointed out that British Prime Minister John Major had been working hard on aid coordination in his role as the current president of the Group of Seven industrialized nations. In fact, today in London, senior officials of the Group of Seven, the European Community, the World Bank, and International Monetary Fund met to discuss the implementation of emergency aid. The purpose of the meeting was to ensure that the $11 billion in food aid and other assistance that's been pledged to the Soviet Union and its republics be delivered rapidly and effectively to those who need it. A spokesman for the British Foreign Office said the group had agreed to intensify their efforts in that regard. Also today, the German government welcomed the U.S. initiative, saying it had long been urging greater Western coordination of aid to the Soviet Union. I'm John Idstein in London.
Ethnic violence broke out today in the Soviet Republic of Moldavia. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports from Moscow.
The Moldavian authorities say the violence began when ethnic Russian gunmen opened fire on a police post on a bridge over the river which separates the republic's two main ethnic communities. The authorities claim leaders of the Russian minority wanted to scupper any chances of an agreement between the pro-independence president, Mircea Snegur, and the new Commonwealth of Independent States. But officials inside the Russian-speaking area give a completely different account of events. They say several hundred Moldavian policemen launched an invasion of their territory, which they've proclaimed to be a separate republic. The aim, they say, was to enforce a Moldavian parliamentary decision calling for the ethnic Russian militia to be disarmed. Whatever the case, the bloodshed highlights the Moldavian government's difficulty in building new links with other former Soviet republics in the face of opposition from both its Russian minority and its ethnic Romanian majority.
Tim Hewell of the BBC in Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 19 points. This is NPR. On the eve of a trip to the Soviet Union, Secretary of State James Baker says one subject of his talks with Soviet officials will be the safety of nuclear weapons. At a news conference, Baker said so far there have not been any changes in nuclear command and control that would cause grave concern. Baker refused to comment on whether or not Soviet leader Gorbachev is on his way out and said that the U.S. would not become involved in a power struggle in Moscow. President Bush said that he has received very positive assurances from the central government and the various Soviet republics that nuclear arms are being handled with a maximum amount of safety. President Bush's national campaign chairman said today that Mr. Bush will campaign aggressively in New Hampshire, the site of next year's first presidential primary. Martin Murray of New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
A poll last week reported that the president has lost favor with many voters in this recession-plagued state. One day after opening Mr. Bush's reelection headquarters here, Bob Teeter said the president won't avoid the subject when he visits.
The economy is very bad here. It is not very good any place in the country. He knows that. He understands it. He understands that's why some of his poll numbers are down. And he is going to do everything he can to try and turn the economy around and restore economic growth as rapidly as possible.
According to Teeter, Mr. Bush will visit New Hampshire often in the month preceding the February 18th primary, but will not debate his Republican challenger, Pat Buchanan. Teeter said the president will focus instead on the democratically controlled Congress. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Murray in Concord, New Hampshire.
The government says that consumer prices were up 0.4% last month, mainly because of higher food and energy expenses. The Labor Department says that food prices were up 0.6% due to high cost for fruits and vegetables. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The question everyone is asking, but no one can answer, is who's in control of the 27,000 nuclear weapons in the arsenal of what used to be the Soviet Union? My guest, William Potter, directs the Center for Russian and Soviet Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. In October, he led a conference in the Soviet Union on nuclear nonproliferation. He doesn't know who's in control of the Soviet nuclear weapons, but he's been researching a couple of related areas that are changing the international nuclear picture. We called him to talk about how the former Soviet republics are selling off their nuclear technology and how Soviet scientists are selling their nuclear expertise to other countries. Many of the nuclear scientists are now out of work and are leaving the Soviet Union, and Potter says that's cause for concern.
You have a very, very large nuclear community, a community that has developed in the past 40 years alongside the Soviet nuclear weapons program. There are figures which suggest that you may have approximately 100,000 Soviet nuclear scientists with top-level nuclear clearances. You're also talking about some 3,000 to 5,000 individuals who have actually worked with uranium enrichment and plutonium production, two of the most sensitive phases in the nuclear weapons production process. These individuals would be a tremendous assistance to any country which sought a nuclear weapon.
Are they being recruited now?
Well, we have been told, I was told while I was in Moscow several months ago, that there are reported cases in which Soviet nuclear scientists traveling abroad had been approached by foreign governments for employment.
What kind of governments? Third world governments looking to build a nuclear weapons program?
Well, I think, I mean, you have your standard list of likely candidates. These include, in particular, countries in the Middle East. Libya and Iraq are the two that are most often mentioned as having actually actively sought to recruit Soviet scientists. There have been some reports which suggest that countries in Latin America, as well as India, have sought to recruit scientists. It has been recently noted that some 19 top Soviet nuclear scientists emigrated to Israel this past year. I would not treat them as nuclear mercenaries, and yet the impact on the Israeli nuclear program may be the same as if they actively recruited these individuals. It's quite interesting if one looks at Central Asia in particular, which, contrary to, I think, the conventional wisdom, does have a substantial nuclear infrastructure.
I'm wondering how much direct contact you've had with any Soviet scientists and if the issue of nuclear ethics is a big, much-discussed issue now in the former Soviet Union.
But I direct a large international project which focuses on creating a community of nonproliferation specialists in the former Soviet Union. And we have very close ties with Soviet scientific research institutes in a number of the republics of the former Soviet Union. I think they all share my basic concern that given the dire economic situation in the former Soviet Union, that regardless of the ethics that generally guide the behavior of these individuals. If they become unemployed, if they are short of food, if housing is problematic, that they may well be tempted by a well-heeled proliferator that offers them even a very, very modest stipend.
So that materialistic gain would supersede idealistic or ethical concerns?
Well, I mean, I would be reluctant to put it in terms of materialistic gain. I mean, if one is starving, if one doesn't have shelter, is that a question of materialistic gain? I think, I mean, to kind of relate to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I mean, there are certain primary needs, and those include food and shelter. And unfortunately, those very, very basic needs are no longer given in the Soviet context.
Another concern of yours is what will happen to already existing Soviet technology, nuclear power technology, nuclear weapon technology. Is it going to be sold off piecemeal to the buyers willing to offer the most for it? Has that already started to happen?
Yes, I think we are now, in fact, witnessing the selling off of much of the Soviet Union, and unfortunately that includes much of the defense sector and increasingly, I'm afraid, portions of the nuclear sector as well.
What's being bought and sold?
They have made exports to a number of countries that are not party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which would provide assistance to those countries' nuclear weapons programs. What you have seen, though, most recently is the emergence of private nuclear entrepreneurs, individuals and firms which are able to acquire sensitive nuclear material, equipment, and technology at wholesale discount prices from the state sector and then to market them abroad. There have been recent cases, particularly in Italy and Switzerland, which suggest that Soviet origin, low-enriched uranium, and possibly also a very small quantity of plutonium may have found its way to Europe. There are also reports of various materials, some including nuclear materials, finding their way from the former Soviet Union to Poland and then on to Western Europe. There also have been reports of the entry of Soviet scientists into the international black market, in particular making use of Budapest as an intermediary link between the former Soviet Union and South Africa. Those are among the recently reported cases of what might be called black market activities. There's also an extraordinary case involving a corporation, a private company known as the International Chetek Corporation, which is trying to market so-called peaceful nuclear explosives.
What does that mean, peaceful nuclear explosives?
Basically, the only difference between a peaceful nuclear explosive and a nuclear weapon is the use to which the device is put. A peaceful nuclear explosive, presumably, is a nuclear device which is used for peaceful purposes.
What kind of peaceful purposes would you use it for?
Well, this particular corporation, the Chetek Corporation, suggests that they have an environmentally sound means of disposing of toxic waste, chemical weapons, decommissioned nuclear reactors, and even nuclear weapons, that by detonating nuclear weapons underground, they can, in fact, rid the world of much of its ecological problem. And so it's a very risky proposition. What I regard, though, is most dangerous is not the environmental impact, but rather the fact that it suggests that a private company might, in fact, have access to the most sensitive nuclear material, in this instance, actual nuclear devices.
Do you know if anybody has bought the so-called peaceful nuclear explosives yet?
The company has, in fact, retained a public relations firm in Montreal, Canada, to promote their marketing. To the best of my knowledge, there have not yet been any takers. The danger, though, I think is acute because of the relationship that has been entered into between this one particular company and the Ministry of Atomic Power and Industry, which is the ministry in the government which is supposed to control all aspects of the Soviet nuclear weapons program. You have a situation where a private company is infusing cash into a governmental ministry to keep it afloat in return for exclusive rights to peaceful nuclear explosive services. This is an extremely dangerous situation because you're talking about the ministry which is supposed to monitor exports of nuclear materials being dependent upon a private company for its survival when that private company is trying to market nuclear services. So it's a very incestuous kind of relationship.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. William Potter. He's a director of the Center for Russian and Soviet Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He also directs the Soviet Nonproliferation Project there. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. William Potter, director of the Center for Russian and Soviet Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. What other formerly secret military or space technology is being marketed now in the Soviet Union, is being sold off?
Almost everything is available. I mean, the large nuclear missile, the SS-18s, which so alarmed the United States in the past, are now being marketed for peaceful civilian space research. Basically, everything is available, from the most modern tanks to the most modern aviation equipment to actual nuclear materials and rockets. Everything, for the right price, I would argue, anything is available.
Are there any trade regulations that should prevent the former republics from selling off nuclear weapons?
Well, I think the question is a good one. The Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, in fact, generally exercised considerable restraint in the nuclear export realm. In fact, one of the ironies, given the Cold War relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, was that there is also a very cooperative relationship in the nonproliferation realm. Bilateral meetings take place every 6 months between the Soviet Union and the United States. You did have a system of export controls that appeared to work relatively effectively in the former Soviet Union. What's happened is that with decentralization, with the economic problems that have arisen, with the collapse of central controls, and with the proliferation of new private trading companies, the old mechanism for export control has basically collapsed. To give you a sense of the magnitude of the problem, I mean, the Soviet Union today, what remains of it, is not able to afford to send its representatives to participate in international nuclear export control meetings. And the situation is so severe that my small project at the Monterey Institute has been approached by representatives in the Soviet Union who are seeking to find means to send a single individual to a nuclear export control meeting. That's how acute the problem is. The Soviets were not able to send a representative to the last meeting a number of months ago in Annapolis, Maryland, which dealt with dual-use exports. They simply can't afford it. If they can't afford to participate in international meetings, how in the world are they going to be able to afford to maintain an effective nuclear export control system throughout the former Soviet Union? It's a tremendous problem.
You've identified some pretty serious problems about how nuclear expertise and nuclear weapons and nuclear technology are leaving the Soviet Union and going into the hands of other countries. Do you have any solutions to propose about how the Soviet nuclear technology can be controlled?
I think in the short term, the most critical step that must be taken, and I would argue to date has not been effectively taken, by the United States, cooperation with our major Western allies, is to make it absolutely clear to all of the would-be independent states, formerly of the Soviet Union, that diplomatic recognition will not be forthcoming until the states accede to the Nonproliferation Treaty, put in export regulations. I think it also is really incumbent upon us at this moment to begin a program targeting for economic assistance in a variety of ways those most critical sectors of the Soviet nuclear workforce. These include individuals, for example, some 3,000 to 5,000 individuals who deal with uranium enrichment and plutonium production. If these individuals become unemployed, they are the ones who will be most coveted by other would-be nuclear weapon states. To some extent, we can solve the problem by actually hiring these individuals in American universities. But I think that's probably the wrong approach, because what it does is it removes an proliferation problem, but it also removes some of the most talented individuals from the former Soviet Union. So what I would suggest as one means to deal with the potential brain drain and non-proliferation problem is to work on a program for retooling nuclear scientists to work on cleanup of the environmental damage caused by nuclear weapons production. What I think is particularly attractive about this notion of making the people who made the mess clean it up, and in the same fashion also dealing with the economic problem, is that there's a certain symmetry between the problem as it exists in the Soviet Union and the United States. We, too, have a tremendous environmental problem caused by nuclear weapons production.
So maybe we could benefit by their conversion.
Exactly. One can make the, I think, attractive argument politically in the United States that investments in a job program for assisting Soviet scientists to clean up their nuclear weapons mess would, in fact, directly and very tangibly also benefit the United States in the way of learning new techniques, refining techniques for decontamination and waste disposal.
William Potter directs the Center for Russian and Soviet Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in California. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from the Soviet Union today?
Well, we'll be hearing from NPR's Mike Schuster in Moscow about the announcement of several Asian republics of the Soviet Union that they will be joining in the Commonwealth of Independent States. That's the organization of Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and now these others that would be a successor to the Soviet Union, but not nearly so centralized. Also, a special report tonight remembering those Japanese who were in the United States, either as diplomats, students at the time of Pearl Harbor, who then went back to Japan. And we'll be hearing about a book of cruel and unusual puns.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The big question of the holiday movie season is whether Steven Spielberg's new version of the Peter Pan story can make us forget Mary Martin and Cyril Richard. Film critic Stephen Schiff has the news about Hook.
The news, I'm afraid, is disappointing, especially when you consider that Hook is the second most expensive movie ever made, and that it marks Steven Spielberg's return to what he supposedly does best, cooking up childhood fantasies that enthrall adults, too. This was meant to be the movie about the boy who wouldn't grow up by the boy who wouldn't grow up. But I'm afraid Spielberg's youthful bounce has given way to the creaky plot of an upper-level manager with a job to do. An enormous job. Spielberg has to convince us that after years of off-and-on cavorting with the steadily aging Wendy, Peter Pan finally fell in love with her granddaughter, Moira, whereupon he promptly turned into a plain old kid, grew up, married Moira, and developed a case of amnesia about the years when his best friend was someone named Tinkerbell. Now Peter's a hard-charging mergers and acquisitions lawyer, played by Robin Williams, and we know the movie's in trouble when he promises to make it to his son's crucial Little League game and then doesn't because he's working on a vital deal. If you guessed that the distracted son suffers the game-losing strikeout as a result, well, you've probably seen the same movie Spielberg is stealing from. Anyway, Peter and his wife and his two kids are off to London to visit Granny Wendy, now 90. Her house looks awfully familiar, particularly that upstairs bedroom with its big window open to the stars. One night, the grown-ups come home to find that a certain Captain Hook has kidnapped Peter's children, hoping to lure his old nemesis into a final pitched battle. But even when Tinkerbell herself shows up, in the form of Julia Roberts, to fly her pal back to Never Never Land, Peter can't quite accept who he is. Neither can Captain Hook, who's played by Dustin Hoffman. He ties Peter's children up in a net, and when Peter finds them aloft and screaming, well, his reaction might disappoint any self-respecting buccaneer.
Mr. Hook, I want those kids out of that net in less than 1 minute, or you better get an attorney and hope to God he's better than me.
Who are you?
I'm Peter Panning, attorney at law. Those are my children, and I want them back, please.
Those are your
children.
These are your children.
Yes, they are.
And you're
Peter.
You're Peter?
Yes.
You're Peter?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
You're Peter?
Yes. Is there an echo in here? Yes,
I'm... My great and worthy opponent?
Yes.
The rest of the movie is part regarding Henry, part Iron John, with a little bit of Rockies 1-5 thrown in for good measure. Peter has to spurn his 80s Wall Street carapace and rediscover his joyous, youthful soul. That's the regarding Henry part. He does it by hanging out with the Lost Boys and roughhousing himself into higher consciousness. That's the Iron John part. And then, of course, he has to get strong and learn how to fly and defeat Captain Hook, like Rocky in green tights. All of which turns out to be incredibly boring. First, because the Lost Boys are very lost actors. Second, because the famously elaborate sets never stop looking like famously elaborate sets. And third, because despite Spielberg's usual play of wondrous lights and glowing upturned faces and crashing John Williams music, everything in Hook feels mechanical and dead. Even Dustin Hoffman, who gives the movie's best performance, is more fussy than scary. Julia Roberts, meanwhile, doesn't have much to do but smile that thousand-watt smile and egg the boys on. Robin Williams is winning as Peter, but the closer he inches toward redemption, the closer he also inches toward icky. This is a Peter Pan almost devoid of the requisite fairy dust, and the place it flies us to isn't magical Never Never Land, I'm afraid. It's plain old Hollywood.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester. It's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Film director Andrei Konchalovsky is a Soviet emigre who comes from a long line of Soviet artists. His father wrote the lyrics to the national anthem. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Konchalovsky talks about returning to Russia to film the story of the man who was Stalin's movie projectionist. I'm Terry Gross. That and more on the next Fresh Air.